From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and Hillary Clinton is campaigning in Florida today on her 69th birthday. Donald Trump heading to North Carolina. He has been in Washington, D.C., presiding over the opening of his new luxury hotel just blocks from the White House.
And Trump has dispatched running mate Mike Pence to Nevada, where recent polls show Clinton in the lead, and President Obama stumped for her and took aim down ballot as well this past weekend. The Nevada Republican Senate candidate Joe Heck is in a fierce battle with Democrat Catherine Cortez Masto. Heck had endorsed Donald Trump but took it back after that tape of Trump bragging about sexual assault. The president said, too late.
And now that Trump's poll numbers are cratering, suddenly he says, I'm not supporting him. Too late. You don't get credit for that.
Now, this is a big Senate race. Heck and Cortez Masto are vying to fill the seat of retiring Democratic Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid. So we start this hour with our Senate tracker. Carrie Kaufman is host and producer at KNPR's State of Nevada. She joins us from Las Vegas. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, Robin. How you doing?
Good. And first to Joe Heck. He currently represents Nevada's 3rd congressional district. As we said, he just took back his endorsement of Donald Trump. What are people there saying about how the president took him on?
Poor Joe Heck is squeezed between two camps, right? He's squeezed between the people who love Donald Trump and thinks that he just sold him out. And he's squeezed between moderates and Democrats who say, hey, what took you so long? Trump has been this way the entire race. And just now you're saying that he's too much for you.
Well, he also apparently is taking it on the chin because of his views on immigration. Here he is at a debate earlier this month from KLAS-TV and Univision.
If we don't fix our legal system, we will continue to have the problems that we face today. The fact is, when somebody does come through the legal channels and becomes a permanent legal resident or even gets citizenship, they shouldn't have to wait 10 to 12 years in order to bring their spouse or their family over. So let's talk about fixing the legal immigration system as well. Let's develop a robust guest worker program that meets the unmet demands here in the United States while not disenfranchising unemployed Americans, both unskilled and high tech. We have critical needs. Let's work, as I did, in drafting legislation with many members that are probably in the audience tonight to come up with a way for dreamers to get a path to citizenship.
Boy, Carrie Kaufman, that's the Republican in Nevada, state that has, issues with immigration. How's that going over?
You know, Joe Heck is actually really well-liked as a congressman. The problem is he is not a hardcore conservative. He is pretty much a moderate, and moderates can't really get much done. And so he's been seen as not really getting anything done. But a couple of years ago in his first term, he actually proposed a pathway to citizenship for immigrants if they get a post-secondary education, a degree, or join the military. And he is a member of the military himself. So he's not really far off from Catherine Cortez Masto in this.
Yeah. Well, let's look at Catherine Cortez Masto. She was the Nevada Attorney General from 2007 to 2015. You spoke with her. Gun control came up. Let's listen.
My husband's a retired Secret Service agent. We own guns in my home. And I grew up with a father and uncles and cousins who were hunters here in Nevada, and they own guns. And I think any responsible gun owner gets the idea that we have to start reducing gun violence so that criminals and terrorists and mentally ill and individuals that shouldn't have access to guns, we don't make it easy for them to do so. And we know by just common sense solutions like expanding the background checks, we can prevent that. We can stop more people from accessing and getting those guns that shouldn't have those guns.
Yeah. Carrie Kaufman, I love when politicians go against type. And so in this state, you had, as you said, a moderate Republican who wanted immigration reform. And here you have a Democrat who grew up with guns.
Right.
And by the way, you reached out to Joe Heck to talk about that as well. But how is gun control playing out in your race?
What this centers around in Nevada is that there's a ballot question one, which is a background check question to close loopholes for gun shows and internet. And that is kind of informing everything here. People see it. I think if you got Joe Heck and Catherine Cortez Masto in a room and said, what do you think about gun control? They would say the same thing. Yes, we should close these loopholes. Yes, we should have common sense measures for gun control. But what the NRA sees is that this is the first step to a slippery slope, and Joe Heck cannot go down that slippery slope. Whereas Masto, as many people here in Nevada grew up with guns, can say, look, I'm a gun owner. I like having guns, but the Second Amendment is not absolute. Mm, yeah. There needs to be some regulation.
Well, as we mentioned, this is to replace Harry Reid. Cortez Masto, the Democrat, supports Hillary Clinton. The conservative Koch brothers have invested millions in the Republican candidate. What's the sense of how much interest there is in this race, outside money and what people are saying there?
Well, you know what? The outside money is pretty much even. Cortez Masto has raised about $1.7 million more. She's at $33.7 million. He's at about $32 million even from outside money into this race in Nevada.
Yeah.
In our little state.
Yeah, in your little state with a big, big seat at hand. What are the polls saying at this point?
You know, before the Access Hollywood tape came out, Heck was ahead by about 3 points. Now Cortez Masto is ahead by about 3 points. I believe 538 just had her with a 57% chance of winning.
Yeah, well, that's mm-hmm. a race to watch on election eve. Carrie Kaufman, host and producer at KNPR State of Nevada, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, if you've ever donated money to a political candidate or asked for information on a campaign website, you might have noticed that your email inbox gets flooded with fundraising appeals, perhaps from candidates you've never heard of. Dave Davies from Here and Now contributor WHYY tried to find out why.
Here's the subject line of an email I got recently.
Dave, I need your opinion.
Now, the sender uses my first name, so I might think it's a friend, but no, it's the Heritage Foundation, and what they really want is not my opinion, but a contribution. As a political reporter, I get a lot of these emails. The subject lines are supposed to grab you. Here's Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid warning Republicans are about to win an important fundraising battle.
Tonight could be a disaster.
So you better give right now, so it isn't. And here's one of my favorites. This came from Ivanka Trump.
I'd love to meet you.
Just to be clear, that's my friend Heidi, not Ivanka, reading the message. For a donation of just $3, I'd be entered in a drawing to have coffee with Ivanka at Trump Tower, travel expenses included. How did we get here? Karen Rosenkrantz is a Washington-based consultant who helps campaigns with digital strategies and is considered a pioneer of political email fundraising. She says it started with Howard Dean's presidential bid.
Howard Dean sent out that first one, if you can believe it, in 2004 into the political realm. And everybody sort of raised their eyebrows and said, oh, this might be a way for us to raise more money.
Rosenkrantz employed the technique for the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee 2 years later, and the positive results inspired everybody in politics to jump into the game. She says a lot of campaigns now generate a third of their revenue from online appeals, amounting to hundreds of millions of dollars. One effect is that more candidates can draw on a national fundraising base. People who live in congressional districts without competitive races now get email pitches from candidates in other districts, even other states, who do need their help. Aubrey Montgomery, a Philadelphia-based fundraising specialist, says that's because campaigns share email lists.
So even if you had given to one person one time 2 years ago, your email has probably been traded a dozen or more times in the last year.
Rosenkrantz says more people getting into online fundraising means that around crunch time, as an election or fundraising deadline approaches, everyone's emails are competing for attention.
There's going to be so much political email coming in that if you want to be seen, you can't just send one email. You might have to send three in order to be somewhere close to the top of someone's inbox.
What's the effect on potential donors? I asked people standing in line for a Michelle Obama rally if they get political fundraising emails.
Multitudes. I get them from all over the country, from Cory Booker, Tammy Baldwin in Wisconsin. It's really overkill.
It always says, give $8, give $50, give $32.
Every day. I read them and then I delete them.
Like any other ad, you can always ignore these online marketing pitches, but enough people seem to contribute to make them worth sending out again and again. Karen Rosenkrantz says they could be a good thing. In this world of big money donors, she says they help get people back in the process.
It's people and small dollar donations that are making the difference in some of these races across the country. And I think that's really a profound impact on our political process. You know, you get to really own and invest in these campaigns, and it's not just a few big dollar donors.
In any case, the emails are here to stay, and candidates will try to get us to open them with catchy subject lines, like this one from Illinois Congressman Brad Schneider.
They're making me send this.
Schneider says he'd rather share cat videos, but his campaign has bills to pay. For Here and Now, I'm Dave Davies in Philadelphia.
This election season, no state has more ballot measures than California. Voters there will decide on 17 propositions. We'll hear about some of them, including repeal of the death penalty, gun control, and whether to raise the tobacco tax. But first, Proposition 58, which would end the mandate on English-only education and make it easier for schools to start dual language immersion programs. About one in four public school students in California speaks a language other than English at home. And nearly 20 years ago, California voters agreed that the best way to teach these students English was to do away with the existing bilingual education programs and immerse the students in English. Adolfo Guzman Lopez of KPCC visited a school in San Gabriel in Los Angeles County to see how a change in the law would play out.
13 students work in groups of four and five.
Sam has my hat.
Teacher Jenny Tan gives kindergarten-level lessons to fifth graders who've been in the U.S. less than a year. This is a newcomer's class at McKinley Elementary School.
Okay, let's read the direction together. Circle? What does circle mean? Yes.
Did you hear that ticking? It's from an apple-shaped timer. It'll ring when it's time to move on to the next lesson.
The clock is ticking.
Principal Jim Simmons says it's a reminder that state law says these students will have to sink or swim in their main English-only classes next year. Many swim.
But there's some where that clock ticks and they're not ready yet to go into that main class, but the law requires us that we can't keep them in this program any longer than a school year.
Simmons says new research suggests those students would struggle less if teachers could use their native languages a lot more.
We could spend more time teaching them in their native language and working on that proficiency and getting to those higher level thinking skills. I think they'd be that much further ahead academically in that and be able to pick up English faster.
But that's currently prohibited by state law. In 1998, California voters passed Proposition 227, which required teaching these kids in English only.
Bilingual education is dead, and it's not coming back.
That's Ron Unz, the Silicon Valley entrepreneur who authored and funded the Prop 227 campaign.
The old system put hundreds of thousands, a good fraction of a million immigrant students in a program where they were not taught English as soon as they started school.
He's right. In the 90s, many students did languish in ineffective bilingual programs. But instead of replicating good programs, Prop 227, for the most part, threw them all out. Activists who wanted to make English this country's official language supported Prop 227 and opposed the current California measure to lift bilingual education limits. They argue that learning English right away is the most powerful tool to succeed in this country. But others, including Marcelo Suarez Orozco, an education researcher at UCLA, believe that times have changed and so should the law.
Well, you can't be the fifth largest economy on earth and not understand that bilingualism is a huge advantage.
Suarez Orozco says new brain research suggests Prop 227 was a detour to a dead end.
We can do both. We can chew and walk. We can keep the home languages. And at the same time, we can make the transition to English competence.
He says some of the best bilingual teaching took place in dual immersion programs. And despite Prop 227's English-only mandate, dual immersion programs have been thriving in many schools. To participate, parents need to sign waivers yearly. McKinley Elementary started a dual immersion program 3 years ago. Principal Jim Simmons takes me on a tour.
So this is a kindergarten dual language, so dual immersion. So they're learning 90% in Spanish, 10% in English.
Here, there are no limits on the use of the foreign language.
Okay, ¿quién es?
Color.
¿Quién es? ¿Eres tú?
The hair.
¿Eres Owen? Yeah.
This class is a mix of English learners and native English speakers. Simmons says the clock is not ticking on the newcomer students to learn English.
It's kind of the opposite theory. You know, this is, we're looking at the long-term picture of student achievement. The gains we're really not going to start seeing till the upper grades and into high school.
If Prop 58 erases bilingual education limits, he says, more schools in California could start dual immersion programs and teachers could offer other students more help in the kids' native languages. Whether that happens or not will be up to voters on November 8th. For Here and Now, I'm Adolfo Guzman Lopez.
Well, in addition to Proposition 58, California voters will also decide a number of other high-stakes issues. And joining us from San Francisco to talk about some of them is Scott Schaefer of Here and Now contributor KQED. Hi, Scott.
Hey, Jeremy.
So 17 measures on the ballot. Two are about the death penalty. Let's start with those, Props 62 and 66. Tell us about those proposals.
Yeah, so I think both sides on capital punishment agree on one thing, Jeremy, and it is that California's death penalty system is broken. And so the question is, do we try to fix it or do we scrap it altogether? And that's what these two ballot measures boil down to. Prop 62 would abolish the death penalty and replace all those those sentences with life in prison without the possibility of parole. Prop 66 would say no, and their slogan is no, let's mend it, don't end it. Let's try to speed up these legal appeals, which drag on for decades. So that's basically the choice that voters are presented with.
And what happens if they pass both of those?
Well, if they both pass, whichever one gets more votes would prevail. But I have to tell you, based on polls before the election, I think it's more likely that both will fail because Prop 66, the one to speed it up, doesn't seem to be doing well at all. And Prop 62, to abolish it, is also below the 50% threshold. We'll see what voters do, but I think it's entirely possible that it'll neither be fixed nor scrapped. We'll be stuck with this dysfunctional status quo.
We should also point out that Californians rejected a ballot measure to eliminate the death penalty back in 2012. Did the proponents of the prop that would abolish the death penalty think that things had changed?
Well, yeah, I think public attitudes have changed a little bit. I mean, for one thing, fewer death sentences are being handed down in California and across the country. There have been more stories about exonerations and wrongful executions that are of course, disturbing. And then you've got other states like Connecticut and Nebraska that have abolished the death penalty altogether. So I think they're just, you know, feeling a changing sense of public opinion.
All right. What about Proposition 63 on gun control? California has some of the strictest gun control laws in the country. How is Prop 63 different from what's there already?
Well, in some ways, it's very similar. In fact, the governor and the legislature just recently enacted some laws that are very much overlapped with Prop 63. One thing it does is it would help take guns away from felons. There are some 20,000 guns in the hands of convicted felons in California who shouldn't have them, so it would do that. It would also regulate ammunition. It would ban gun magazines with more than 10 rounds of bullets. And, you know, polls show this is very popular. Like I said, it does overlap with what the governor signed into law this year and in past years, but it's being pushed by Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom, who's running for governor in 2018. And I think he sees this as he says it's important for voters to weigh in on this because then only voters can change it, not the legislature, who might be pressured by the NRA or other groups.
Is the NRA spending a lot of money to try to defeat this?
You know, not really. The Yes on 63 campaign, the campaign to enact this gun control, has raised about $5 million. The No on 63 campaign has raised less than $1 million, and that includes money from the NRA. So I think they've seen the polls, Prop 63, very popular, and I think they're putting their money in other states where similar measures are on the ballot.
What about the proposition to legalize recreational marijuana in California? This is one of five states that's voting on this issue this year. How likely is that to pass?
Polls have shown it leading. It's been getting around 60% support. But, you know, there's time still for voters to consider this. I think it could tighten before the election. Both sides are spending money. But I have to tell you, the Yes side, the side to legalize this, has vastly outraised the No side. They've raised $23 million, a lot of it from Sean Parker, the Napster founder, early Facebook investor. The No side has only raised about $1.5 million. So a huge disparity in the money.
Well, we just spent the last couple days broadcasting from Colorado, where recreational marijuana and medical marijuana are legal. And we spoke with the governor there, John Hickenlooper, who opposed legalization. And here's what he said would be his advice to other states considering legalizing it.
I think the jury's still out. And when other governors ask me, I tell them they should wait a couple of years.
If California does legalize, is it ready for what comes next?
You know, I think there are always unintended consequences and unforeseen consequences of any ballot measure, and marijuana is probably not different than that. You know, the fact is it's really easy right now to get marijuana in California. You need a medical pot card, a medical ID card, but it's extremely easy to get one. So in that sense, the state has been dealing with the availability of marijuana for some time now. They've also, the backers of this measure have learned a little bit from what Colorado and Washington State have been going through, and they've tried to incorporate some of those, say, protections for children into the ballot measure. So, you know, that said, yes, there's always things that you didn't anticipate. And, you know, the problem with a ballot measure in California is if you realize, oh, there's a problem with this, only the voters can change it. They have to go back to the ballot.
Scott, just about a minute left, but tell us about the proposition that would raise taxes on tobacco.
Yeah, there's a $2 a pack tax on the ballot. California's cigarette tax is actually pretty low. It's 87 cents right now. The national average is about $1.65. This has been on the ballot a couple times in the past two decades. It failed narrowly both times. Polls show it leading this time. But again, the tobacco industry has come in with lots of money. They've raised $71 million to defeat this compared to the about less than half of that for the yes side. But we'll see. It is leading in the polls. And it does seem to be, you know, so it seems to be popular. But, you know, those ads do have an impact on voters.
And we keep talking about Election Day coming up. Are people are already voting in California in some places, right?
Oh, yeah. We've already had over a million people cast ballots. So people are very engaged, and a half a million people registered just in the last 2 days, Sunday and Monday, before the registration deadline.
That's Scott Schaefer, senior editor at KQED's Politics Desk. Scott, thanks so much.
You bet.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron, helping make delicious home-cooked meals by sourcing from artisanal suppliers, family-run farms, fisheries, and ranchers. Whether it's Japanese ramen noodles, wild-caught Alaskan salmon, or heirloom tomatoes, you choose from a range of recipes that can be made in 40 minutes or less. Pre-measured ingredients delivered to your door only when you want. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/here. New recipes are created each week. That's blueapron.com/here.
And we're getting insight into the roots of the opioid epidemic from a new investigation by STAT, the health and medicine publication and our weekly partner. Through unsealed documents, STAT learned that in 2001, state officials in West Virginia were seeing a surge in deaths linked to the painkiller OxyContin, and they moved to require their state insurer and its benefits manager, Merck Medco, require a prior authorization for the drug. You know, you can't get it unless the insurance company says you really need it. But the documents show Purdue Pharma, which makes OxyContin, was also paying Merck Medco to boost sales of the drug. David Armstrong is senior enterprise reporter for STAT. David, how'd they do this?
Yeah, so the benefits manager is actually contracting with both parties here. They are working for the insurance plan, but they also have a contract with Purdue. And Purdue is paying them in the form of what they call rebates to essentially make sure that their drug is getting favored status. And part of that is making sure there's no limits on its prescribing.
Well, you quote a former Purdue official as saying that prior authorization programs don't eliminate inappropriate prescribing, and they can prevent patients who legitimately need drugs from getting them. Is there evidence that this prior authorization that West Virginia desperately wanted, officials there desperately wanted, they told you they were screaming at a wall, you know, trying to get someone to hear them, that would have slowed the opioid epidemic?
Well, there is evidence that these programs do work. And in fact, just this month, the Centers for Disease Control put out a study showing that a prior authorization program here in Massachusetts cut opioid prescribing by 15%. Mm-hmm. So it made a difference. I think also at the time, you have to remember, this is early in the epidemic, and it would have been very symbolic for one of the states that was being hardest hit to put restrictions on this drug. It would have sent a signal, and it's possible that would have sent a message out to other states, other insurance plans, hey, yeah, watch out for this drug, and it might have made a difference.
Well, West Virginia eventually did get prior authorization for OxyContin, but it took years. And they did sue Purdue Pharma, which paid $10 million to the state in 2004. These documents that STAT had unsealed are from that case. But now we understand a county in West Virginia is thinking of suing again.
Yeah, so this case was filed by the state in Welch, which is in McDowell County in southern West Virginia. And what's happened in that county is the problem's gotten even worse since the state settled. And it's so bad, and the county is so desperate for money to help treat people with addiction to these drugs that they have now hired and contracted with a big national law firm to file a new lawsuit against not only Purdue, but other makers of opioid painkillers.
And what about the benefits managers, like Merck Medco?
Well, Merck Medco was bought by a competitor in 2012, but there are still deals like this or similar to this that are being made, and it's one of the knocks on this industry.
In other words, benefit companies that push insurers to prescribe certain medication get this rebate, this kickback from the drug companies for those sales.
Yes, and to critics of the industry, this is a conflict of interest. You know, you're getting paid by one side while representing the other side. Whose interest do you really have at heart?
Yeah. David Armstrong, senior enterprise reporter for our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication, will link you to his recent writing at hereandnow.org. David, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
A recent detail in a USA Today article about a new hiring campaign at the Secret Service caught our eye. It turns out that many of the hugely qualified recruits are rejected because of past use of Adderall. Now, that's the amphetamine that's prescribed legally for attention deficit disorder, but has been illegally abused by college students and others looking for speed. The Secret Service needs to hire 1,000 new agents because the agency has been stretched thin by several controversies, including agents partying with prostitutes and missing breaches of White House security, and the contentious presidential election, which Secret Service Director Joseph Clancy told USA Today needs more protection than ever. Here he is. You can hear a Hillary Clinton video running behind him.
During the campaign, we've had, six times where people have jumped over a bike rack. You know, the buffer that we set in front of the stage. In years past, you wouldn't have that. I think to a degree, people are bolder.
And so he says they need more protection. USA Today's Kevin Johnson covers national law enforcement issues and the Justice Department. Kevin, how bad is this situation at the Secret Service? You talk about hundreds of agents working for free because this is a federal agency, and so there's a cap on their pay and their overtime.
Yes, that's right. It sort of comes at an unfortunate time where the service is trying to move past a number of problems that have loomed in the last 4 years. You mentioned some of them. And now they're making this attempt to rejuvenate the agency by embarking on this unprecedented, at least for the last 10 years anyway, recruiting campaign. And the impetus for that is a staff stretched very, very thinly, working enormous overtime. And as you mentioned, many folks, at least 1,000 agents so far, and that's a third of the agent workforce, has maxed out its combined overtime and salary compensation.
Well, first, stay with that for a second, because that was odd to read. Many of them still working, for instance, on these campaign details. Will they get that money?
Perhaps not. That's still to be determined.
Well, this goes to one of the things you touch on, that these are people who generally are compelled to do this work because they care about their country and they take it seriously, so that they would work even if they've capped their overtime for no pay.
That's right. In many respects, I was listening in on a recruitment effort in Chicago, a session for new recruits, actually, where they were warned, many of the candidates coming in, that there will be times where they will be asked to stand post and not be guaranteed pay for it, many of them working hundreds of hours without such compensation.
Okay, well, that's one issue, and we're going to touch on it again. But now they have this big push to bring in new agents. And great candidates, we're understanding, are making it through until the polygraph or questions about drugs. Here's Secret Service Director Joseph Clancy speaking with USA Today.
We obviously vet our people in many different ways, from polygraph to background checks and so on. And I'm convinced, I'm confident that we are getting the very best. And we can do that. We can be very selective, because of the volume of people that are applying for our job. We often say here, every minute of every hour and every hour of every day, we've got to be at our best.
Again, Secret Service Director Joseph Clancy speaking with USA Today's Kevin Johnson. And Kevin, he's confident, but it doesn't sound as if others are because of this problem of great candidates stumbling when it comes to questions about drug use, especially Adderall. Talk more about that.
Correct. I mean, if you look at the numbers, are very interesting. In fiscal year 16, 27,000 people, potential candidates, applied for agent jobs. 300 agent candidates were hired. So there's a huge numbers that have to be called through to get to that end point. And one of the problems in getting to that end, to getting to the finish line, have been drug histories in many of these candidates. And for many of them, the drugs, the abuse of drugs, mostly prescription drugs, have emerged in recent years like they haven't before in many of the recruiters' memories. They've emerged because a lot of the candidates don't view their use of substances like Adderall and other amphetamines necessarily as being wrong. They've been using it to help them in their studies as a study aid, to be able to work longer into the night. And it was the case for a candidate from Eastern Kentucky University. By all accounts, a very well-qualified individual who drove 6 hours, 400 miles at his own expense to be interviewed by the Secret Service, had passed the original testing, written tests required, and had not disclosed previously that he had used Adderall to help him, for what he said, to become qualified for the very job that he was seeking.
And being rejected from.
And being escorted from the building after acknowledging its use.
And as you write, heartbreaking for him. But, I mean, just stay on this for a second, because is there concern that this is maybe the first wave of college grads who, as you said, thought, you know, there was nothing wrong with this, starting to apply for jobs, and they're discovering this at the Secret Service?
Well, I think it's part – it's one part of what was described to me as sort of a new culture of candidates emerging, where drug use is just one part of a background that's become new to the people who are vetting these candidates. Other problems have emerged in internet use, where before, some of the very people who are interviewing some of these candidates had no history of internet use when they applied for their jobs. So that's become a new issue for the Secret Service and for other law enforcement agencies.
Are you talking about internet abuse or
internet abuse, illegal downloading of material on the internet, and also their communications with friends and others on the internet that could come back to haunt them at some point while working in federal law enforcement.
Fascinating. Well, meanwhile, because of what the Secret Service is discovering as they try to bring in new recruits, has led some people to say that maybe the Secret Service has too much of a mission right now, and there's a move to split their protective mission, you know, guarding a candidate, from their investigative mission, things like investigating cybersecurity. That's obviously not being received well in the agency.
Correct. And this discussion found some traction in the past 4 years as the Secret Service's disclosures continued to stream out of security breaches, misconduct by agents. So folks on the Hill, a number of people in Congress, have raised this question of whether or not the service should be confined to just the protective mission and farm out their responsibility for cyber and the protection of financial institutions. Obviously, as you say, it has not set well with the Secret Service, and Director Clancy indicated that it would be a non-starter for him in terms of any discussion about trying to separate that mission.
That's Kevin Johnson. He covers national law enforcement and the Justice Department for USA Today on the Secret Service's recruiting campaign, which is coming across some stumbling blocks. Kevin, thank you.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
And a quick note now of a new development on another story we've been watching. Defense Secretary Ash Carter said today that the Pentagon will immediately stop trying to collect bonus money given to California Army National Guard soldiers at the height of the Iraq and Afghan wars. It was reported earlier in the week that thousands of soldiers have been told they have to give back recruitment bonuses and tuition assistance they'd been given years before. The total amount is in the millions. The Defense Department says some of those bonuses were given out by recruiters who weren't authorized to do so, and the money was supposed to go to just highly skilled recruits, but the attempt to claw back so much money from veterans who risked their lives at war did not sit well with members of Congress. California Republican Congressman Duncan Hunter told ABC News yesterday that the Defense Department needed to step up.
This is not Congress's fault. This decision came from the Department of Defense, and they were able to stop it then, and they're able to stop it now.
Well, they have stopped it for now. Secretary Carter said in a statement that no money would be collected until steps are taken to make sure service members are treated fairly, that some of the soldiers knew they didn't qualify for the bonuses, but others did not. He asked for a streamlined process to be put in place by January 1st. We'll keep an eye on this story.
After the 9/11 attacks, there was an uptick in the number of people studying the Arab world and Arabic in the United States, a shift from the studies that were more popular following World War II and the Cold War. But now, as political tensions rise between the U.S. and Russia, are U.S. universities ready to shift focus again and put more resources into Russian studies? Joining us now is Regina Smith, who's an associate professor of political science and director of the Russian Studies Workshop at Indiana University in Bloomington, which, by the way, last month received a $1 million grant from the Carnegie Corporation to strengthen its Russian studies program. Regina, welcome.
Hello, and thank you.
Well, and how would you describe the current state of Russian studies in the U.S.?
So I would say that the state of Russian studies is ascendant. For a long time after the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, there was a decline in the concentration of Russian studies across the board, across all approaches to studying the region. And now we're starting to regain interest, resources, and students.
But is it difficult to find the people to teach the classes, to teach about Russian studies because of the fact that there was a decline in interest after the end of the Cold War?
So right now we're in a sweet spot where the old folks are still here and there are enough new PhDs coming up to fill the slots. But there's a crisis coming. There's an issue coming.
What is the crisis that's coming?
The crisis is that the lack of interest in the Soviet period in the late 1990s and early 2000s led to a dearth or a lack of specialists being trained at the top U.S. universities to be in government, business, non-governmental organizations, and then to be back in academia to train the next generation.
What about students? Are you finding that there are a lot more students now that want to go into this field?
So I wouldn't say there are a lot. There's a rising number. We're not anywhere near close to where we were in 1988, 89, and 90. But there is increased interest, and we're all very enthusiastic about that.
And are the students that are coming in trained in the kinds of things that it's helpful to know when you're going into Russian studies? And I'm thinking even of the Russian language. A lot of high schools probably used to have Russian as one of the languages you could take, and then maybe did away with it, started teaching Mandarin or Arabic just as the trends changed. Are you finding that students are able to have the knowledge they need to go into Russian studies?
So you're actually exactly right about following the trends, and language training does tend to follow the trends. You can make a lot of money in China, or the Middle East is now a large security problem for the U.S., and students tend to follow those news stories. But Russian was never prevalent at the high school level, unfortunately. And where Russian training was located was at, I would say, a handful of really top university programs within the United States. And those programs have largely been sustained, thankfully. And what we're seeing is student interest returning to engaging Russian language training early in their college career, so as freshmen or sophomores.
Is there something different in the way that you teach Russian studies now, given all that's happened since the end of the Cold War?
Yeah, so two things happened simultaneously between 1990 and 1995. And one was the collapse of the Soviet Union and the end of the Cold War. And the other was how we study these regions. So for a long time after World War II, university focus on regional studies was organized just that way in terms of in-depth knowledge. Around the mid-1980s, we started to have disciplinary revolutions where the way in which we study countries changed to stress statistics and theoretic inquiry as opposed to deep knowledge. And now we're circling back and trying to mesh those two things. That is, join deep knowledge of a region with strong disciplinary training.
Students can only learn so much in a classroom, obviously. What does it take to really develop a deep understanding of Russian culture and politics and Russian relations?
Well, what it really takes is the capacity to be in Russia or any other country that you're trying to study. So it's very hard to have a deep understanding without walking the streets, attending classes in the universities, talking to people, sitting around a kitchen table. Russians are known for kitchen talk. That is sort of hard, factual talk about politics and life around the kitchen table. And that's where you really learn. And so for students, it's imperative that they spend time in the country in order to really understand how to study that country.
What do your students end up doing after they're done with their studies?
So our undergraduate students go on to work in the government. I have several students who go on to work in the Peace Corps, both in the post-communist region and beyond. We have lots of students who work in business after they graduate. Our PhD candidates generally teach. So they get jobs at universities and become the trainers of the next generation.
That's Regina Smith, who is an associate professor of political science and director of the Russian Studies Workshop at Indiana University in Bloomington. Regina Smith, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.